Today is Monday, January 23rd. We're going to be working on the last of the endocrine and blood typing today. All right, so at the top of page 15, we were talking about the pancreas last Wednesday. This particular gland is situated behind your stomach, and it's kind of behind the peritoneum, which wraps and covers most of your digestive organs. So this particular gland has two functions. It's partly an endocrine gland, and it's partly an exocrine gland. It's got two separate, completely different functions. We're not going to focus on exocrine right now. We're going to save that for later. But right now, we're going to focus on the specific cells that make endocrine hormones. So those cells are called islet cells, and we specifically have alpha cells and beta cells. Each one makes a different kind of hormone. So what is made by your alpha cells?
Glucagon,
good. And of course, insulin is made by those beta cells. Each one of these regulates blood glucose. Do they do so synergistically or antagonistically? They do it together? They both raise blood sugar? One raises? Lowers, good. So they're antagonists. So yeah, they both work on blood sugar, but they do so in opposite directions. Blood sugar is raised by glucagon, and blood sugar is lowered by insulin. All right, since they both respond to changing levels of glucose in the bloodstream, we're going to say the pancreas is under humoral control. So it's the response of the humor, or the response of the pancreas to the blood changing levels of glucose. It stimulates the release of either insulin or glucagon. So I want to emphasize a point here. Because your pancreas is in control of blood glucose levels, it is the control center. Your brain is not the control center for blood glucose levels. Your pancreas is. Okay? So that's a really important concept to grasp, because if your pancreas breaks and it don't work anymore, you cannot regulate blood sugar. So if your pancreas doesn't work, specifically, if these islet cells no longer detect blood sugar as they're supposed to, you've got problems. Okay, and so the main problem that arises is a form of diabetes. What form is it? Mellitus, yeah. Okay, so if you're keeping track here, we've got lots of hormones that raise blood sugar. We've got glucagon. We covered an adrenal gland hormone that raises blood sugar known as cortisol. We've got epinephrine that raises blood sugar. And one I didn't mention to you, but growth hormone also raises blood sugar. That's a lot that raise blood sugar, and only one that lowers. What is the only hormone to lower blood sugar? Insulin, yeah. So if it breaks, if those beta cells no longer work properly, now we've got diabetes mellitus. So that's where the problem comes from. It's when the pancreas fails as the control center. So yeah, that's the whole issue here. There's a couple of things that can go on. Sometimes as we age, our cells become insulin resistant, meaning that they're less likely for insulin to transport sugar in, or you may not just make enough insulin. So your pancreas may be trying as hard as it can, and it may not be pumping out enough insulin to lower blood sugar properly. So people, though, who have an inadequate supply from birth due to dysfunctional beta cells have a particular form of diabetes mellitus called type 1 diabetes. And of course, type 1 diabetes is an insulin-dependent form. Type 2 diabetes forms during what time of your life? Adulthood, yeah. Typically, it's called adult-onset diabetes. It comes from either insulin being insufficiently secreted or those cells becoming resistant to letting insulin in with sugar molecules. Either way, if people in that bracket don't watch their diabetes, watch their sugar numbers, then they may in fact end up being insulin dependent. But it can be regulated through diet, exercise, and oral medications. There's a lot of new stuff going on out there on the market, medical-wise, in terms of drugs for this stuff. And there's also some exciting stuff on the horizon in terms of stem cells. they had actually done a transplant of functional beta cells into a person with diabetes mellitus type 1, and they've eliminated her type 1 diabetes. Her body accepted the beta cells and started producing insulin. So, wonderful, that could be a fix down the road for populations with either type 1 or type 2, is to somehow give them a stem cell injection in their pancreas of functional beta cells. That'd be a fantastic fix for a lot of people. Gestational diabetes, while we're on the screen, affects what population of people? Pregnancy, right. So they do a glucose tolerance test around week 28 during pregnancy, and of course, if a woman is not tolerant to glucose and has high blood sugar levels, they classify her with gestational diabetes. So we know there's three classic signs to diabetes. They are the three polys. So what is polyuria?
Excessive urination,
right. Frequent outputs of dilute, light-colored urine. And that comes along with polydipsia, which is frequent.
Thirst, yeah.
So whatever you pee out, you have to replace through drinking. And of course, thirst follows. And then we've got this other symptom of polyphagia, meaning what?
Excessive hunger,
right. So people who have this form of diabetes are going to be hungry to replace the glucose molecules that are washed out with their urine. Now, we talked about diabetes insipidus. What hormone causes diabetes insipidus if it's insufficiently produced? ADH, good. Does diabetes insipidus have those three symptoms? Polyuria and polydipsia. And not polyphagia. So I want to make the point here, diabetes insipidus does not experience the excess hunger. Does that person also have sugar problems? No sugar problems with diabetes insipidus. So just want to distinguish between these two forms of diabetes. Insipidus is a lack of adequate ADH. That person does not have sugar in the urine, high blood sugar, or the hunger to replace those lost calories. Some other symptoms that go along with diabetes, you know, certainly a blood test or a urine test can help us confirm diabetes, but in the absence of those, things like nausea and vomiting come from diabetes as well. Sometimes type 1 diabetics have this condition called ketoacidosis. That particular condition comes from breakdown of fats. So you may say, why in the world would we break down fats if we have high blood sugar? Well, it's because the pancreas no longer detects the normal levels of blood sugar. And the adrenal glands say, hey, let's increase blood sugar by releasing more cortisol. So what does cortisol do? There's two main functions. Raise blood sugar. Anti-inflammatory, yeah. So your body may say, hey, blood sugar's not high enough. Cortisol says, I'll help. Cortisol gets put in the bloodstream, which helps you break down fats and proteins into sugar. And cortisol is also anti-inflammatory. So unfortunately, in the case of diabetes mellitus, cortisol may make the whole problem worse because we're increasing that blood sugar even more. So you ever smell someone's breath who has ketoacidosis? If for those who have smelled it, what's it smell like?
Juicy fruit, yeah.
Okay, if you can imagine taking an alcoholic odor or fingernail polish remover, mixing it with a fruit flavor, that's what the breath of a ketoacidotic person smells like. It's a very odd, fruity alcohol, somewhat flavored odor. Unforgettable once you've smelled it, and it means that person is experiencing high blood sugar due to the breakdown of fats and proteins in the body. So that person needs help most likely. That person needs to lower the blood sugar because it can continue to climb from that point. These are not necessarily, they're not hard and fast rules, but if you have a diabetic who is hot and dry, it probably means the blood sugar is high. And if they're cold and clammy, it probably means the blood sugar is low. So if you don't have a way to test for blood sugar, those are some, you know, general rules of thumb that go along. What are some long-term problems of diabetes? Lots, yeah. excess sugar can collect in your interstitial spaces, and that can create all sorts of problems with blood pressure regulation. That's how we see glaucoma and blindness form. We can see heart damage. We can see high levels of triglycerides form because of all the sugar in the bloodstream. We also see kidney failure occur because of the high pressures, because of the excess sugar, and then we may experience amputation of limbs because, once again, of the high sugar collecting in those extremities, not being able to transport it out and get it gone in the urine. Okay. Do you have any questions so far about insulin, glucagon, diabetes? Okay. Last little bit here for us is over on the next page. This is pineal. They say it increases risk for type 2 later on. It's not a guarantee that woman will get type 2, but it's supposed to go away after the baby's born. And if it doesn't, then now we know we've got another underlying problem that wasn't diagnosed. Where's the pineal body or gland located? At the thalamus, good, in the brain, okay? This particular gland is an interesting one. It is hard to detect its direct function, so a lot of this is indirectly measured. This particular hormone produced by the pineal gland is called melatonin. Not to be confused with melanin that gives a skin color. Melatonin is a sleep-inducing hormone. So it drives our sleep and wake cycle, and they do think to some extent it drives our sex and behavior cycles too. But like I mentioned, it's really hard to measure something that's produced in your brain and the effects that it has on your brain, so a lot of this is inferred information. Interesting thing about this particular hormone, you'll notice that it kind of cycles with the daylight and with the nighttime. So if you are exposed to high levels of light, bright light during the nighttime, that actually suppresses going to sleep. So, you know, they tell us shut off our screens, turn off the TV, turn off the bright lit phones, and then go to sleep with a dark room because the darkness will induce sleep. The brightness stimulates us to stay awake. So, interesting stuff here. Animal coats change color oftentimes in the winter. You may notice that rabbits sometimes are white in the wintertime to match the snow on the ground. Not that we have snow, but nonetheless, that's the cycle. And of course, they turn brown in the summer to match the dirt. So the coloration of some animal coats is matched up with the pineal gland. They say that some people have a seasonal affective disorder where they're more depressed and, you know, just kind of down in the dumps in the wintertime, and they think that's related to lower levels of melatonin, or higher levels, rather, melatonin in the wintertime. So, you know, they say, hey, get out, get some sunlight exposure, help to reset your body clock, and that may help to reduce that seasonal affective down in the dumps winter blues that some people get. This is really interesting. I'd love to know more about this. It's hard to measure, but they say that the female menstrual cycle is exposed to moonlight, and that moonlight, they say, is what set up that 28-day cycle for most women. So I don't know if I buy that totally, but it'd be interesting to have some more research and confirm that. So it's light exposure, they think, that regulates a female's monthly cycle. So how do you think somebody who is completely blind from birth, manages knowing when it's daytime and nighttime? Do you think that person has problems with sleep cycles? Oh yeah, yeah. So of course melatonin may be able to help give them a more regulated day and sleep cycle, but yeah, melatonin is really important for helping us establish when we're supposed to be up and when we're supposed to be asleep. Interesting thing they've also done, people who travel across the world, you know, on airplanes, often get jet lag. They get off the airplane, they don't know if it's night or day. And they have these light boxes that they can sit these people in front of that helps their bodies to reset toward that particular time zone's clock. And so that should help to eliminate the issues of jet lag some. Of course, there's going to still be issues of jet lag, but they say that having light exposure is going to help you kind of reacclimate to a new time zone. So it makes sense because this is certainly a light-triggered hormone. Do y'all have any questions on melatonin or the pineal gland? The last one is the thymus gland. Where is that one located? Right over your heart, okay? And so this particular gland is very active during your childhood growing years, but not so much when you're an adult. In fact, by the time you reach adolescence and late puberty, it starts to atrophy, which means it's going to dry up. By the time you're an adult, it's hard to find this thing. It's pretty much gone. So you'll notice its main job is to program T lymphocytes, which are a type of white blood cell. We'll actually talk about those in the next chapter. So think about your life pattern here. When we're young, we're exposed to everything. We catch colds and viruses and bacterial infections. This is the time of life when you build your immune system. So we need the extra T lymphocytes around which produce antibodies in order to program our immune system against infection. By the time you're into your middle to late teenage years, you've probably been exposed to a lot of stuff, and it's no longer necessary to have so much thymosin to program your immune system. So we do see this gland atrophy once we get into adulthood. When you guys cut open the cats in lab, sometime if you get a younger cat, you may find something that looks like a little shriveled tongue up under the sternum. But if you're not careful cutting open through the sternum, you'll destroy the thymus. And if you've got an older cat, it's probably not even there at all. This looks like tissue that you've, you know, removed in opening up the cat. So younger ones may, in fact, have a thymus gland still present. All right, any questions about thymus? Yay, you're done with the endocrine system. Okay, so we can check that one off our list. So what I normally do with the blood chapter is I do it a little bit backwards. I start with blood typing first to give your brain ample opportunity to make connections and learn that. And then I go back and I cover the main material. Since the blood typing exercise is probably most fresh in your mind from lab, would you prefer that I start with blood typing? Or do you feel comfortable with blood typing from lab?
Start with it, okay.
Anybody else need the sign-in sheet? Thanks. Okay. So if we're going to start with blood typing, let's turn to page 29. You know, we're going to do it backwards. We're going to start here. We'll come back to the beginning later on. I'd like to show you some really fantastic websites. This link to the Nobel Prize website is in your D2L announcements, and it is a really great game to play. You can do the quick game, you can do the mission-based game, you can play them all, and what they're going to do is give you a patient. We'll just select one, and then we're going to blood type that patient. And it walks you through, you know, placing the blood drops in each one of these little test tubes. Okay, and then of course it's going to ask us to type the patient, and then after that it can even give you an opportunity to give them a donation. And so you've got to, once you've typed them, figure out what kind of blood is compatible with their blood type. So this is a really great way to practice your skills. They'll continue throwing examples out at you, so it's a wonderful way to practice. The Blood Cross, or Red Cross rather, has a game also that you can play, but I think you can probably build your skills and be very competent with your blood typing skills and compatibility issues once you get through with that Nobel Prize website. Both of these links are up on the D2L announcement, so if you'd like to play with these between now and test time, I encourage you to do so. If you find another game out there that you enjoy playing for blood typing that works, let me know. These are just two that I thought were pretty good resources. So what I'd like to do is give you some background information first. Blood typing actually depends on your understanding of how the immune system works. So we don't actually cover the immune system in Bio-211. We only cover bits and pieces of it, so you don't actually get the whole picture of how this system works. If any of you go on and take microbiology, either 115 or 225, you'll get more of the immune system in that course. But for us, we need to understand two terms here, antigens and antibodies. So let's take antigens first. Antigens are proteins or substances in your body. They can be found on the surface of cells like your red blood cell, and you'll notice that they can cause clumping if they're perceived as foreign. Let me put it to you this way. If you are sick in the wintertime, and you're so sick that you decide to go and get checked out somewhere, the doctor's office, an urgent care office, they may say, let's see if you've got the flu, and they test you for the flu. They're looking to see if you carry antigens or antibodies against that flu virus. That flu virus, by the way, is considered foreign by your body. Your body's going to fight off that flu virus and try to get rid of it. The way we fight and get rid of foreign stuff like antigens is by using our own specially built antibodies. And these are customized for every virus you encounter, for every bacterial toxin you encounter, for anything foreign that you encounter. So it is a very customized set of cells that make proteins, and these proteins are going to fight off the foreign invaders, whether they're flu virus, the common cold, or even something like somebody else's foreign red blood cells. So I want you to look at the word here, antigen and antibody. Antigen is technically antibody generator. That's where the name comes from. So antigens are typically going to solicit an immune response from your body. In other words, antibodies are probably going to be made if you have antigens present. I also want to tell you that there's two types of antigens. You have your own antigens that your body recognizes as self, and then there are foreign antigens, ones that you don't recognize. So anything that looks like you, sounds like you, smells like you is considered a self antigen. That's okay. Do you need to build antibodies against a self antigen? No. And if you do build antibodies against yourself, guess what happens to you? Yeah. Antibodies fight you, you degenerate, you have an autoimmune disease, and that may be a really debilitating problem. Thyroid disease is autoimmune where your body fights itself. Multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, that's just a few of the problems where the body turns on itself and actually fights itself. Now, if you have a foreign set of antigens, that's where you want the antibodies to come and do the fighting for you. Okay, so let's talk about how this all works. The surface of your cells, including your red blood cells, have surface receptor features. They're kind of like flags that say, hey, I belong here. Or perhaps they're foreign and they have different looking flags that stick up that say, hey, I don't actually belong here. You've got white blood cells that patrol and they check out the glycocalyx. Okay, the glycocalyx is that sticky outer covering of your blood, red cells. Pretty much any cell has that outer surface set of features. So if they look like you, they sound like you, they smell like you, those white blood cells just keep on traveling. There's no need to attack. What if, however, there's some kind of surface feature that says, ooh, this doesn't look like us? Now what does your immune system do? Makes antibodies, right? Those antibodies are actually Y-shaped, like this, and they are custom built for the antigen that they have found. So that means that they are very specific to the types of antigens that you encounter. You see these little portions up here? See how they're custom built to the shape of that antigen? So if you ever see that antigen again, you've got the antibodies in circulation that say, hey, I've seen those, I know exactly what to do with those. It goes and it binds those two foreign antigens and it gets rid of them. So it clumps them and then it carries them off and says, hey, dump these. So this set of antibodies that we've got are very specific to the antigens they encounter. Let me put it to you this way. If you get the flu shot, say in October, and you get the flu in February, you've built antibodies against the flu, and those antibodies clump the flu virus and, of course, can get rid of it because they're present there in circulation. What happens if the flu virus changes its shape between October and February? You've got a case of the flu, don't you? Yep. So your antibodies were built for one shape, and if the shape changes, uh-oh, you're out of luck. So you've really got to have antibodies custom built for those antigens that invade your body. Okay? They make a best guess as to what they think is going to be circulating that winter, and they put, yes, several different varieties in that flu shot, and they just cross their fingers they got it right. Yeah, and sometimes they do hit it right, and then sometimes they miss it by a mile and everybody gets sick. So
it's not like, it doesn't really help.
It's probably better than not having it at all. That person may not have receptors for the flu virus, and you, in fact, may. And the flu version you're getting may not be in the vaccine that you're getting. So, yeah, unfortunately.
What causes, like, you know, some people right after they get the shot, they will, like, first time I ever got a flu shot last year because I had to get one for school,
mm-hmm.
and I was, like, the sickest I've ever been the day after that.
Mm.
And it went away after a day, but...
You felt, like, this awful... It's you're being hit with the virus, and your immune system is having to make antibodies, and it was probably not a great amount of flu antigens in your system, so your body was able to kind of conquer that pretty quickly.
Yeah, because I knew my friend Stephen, that happened to him. He got a flu shot, and in about 3 or 4 days, he ended up in the hospital with a severe type of flu.
Oh, wow.
So it's like it just kind of backfired on him.
Yeah, they'd say it's not for everybody, but works for most.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that lag time, that feeling.
Yeah, I just always heard that, and when it happened to me, I just wondered why you're still getting sick, you know.
When you're feeling bad, you're building antibodies.
Gotcha.
Which is what you want to have happen, yeah. How about other questions so far? Okay, so this is what a red blood cell could look like. It's got these surface antigens, and if these are your antigens, they're considered self, and everything is cool because they look and smell like you. Your body says, hey, that's part of us. No need to attack that. But if this is somebody else's blood cell and that looks totally different from us, uh-oh, now we've got a problem. The immune system consists of white blood cells. Those white blood cells can make antibodies, and those antibodies will have receptors on either end that come and hook up with that antigen, attack it, and then clump it. And so the clumping process is called an antigen-antibody reaction. Boy, that was really scientific, wasn't it? Okay, so the antibodies attack the foreign antigens. All of these Y-shaped structures are antibodies. And look at the clumped up mess we've got. This is called agglutination, where you have this clumping occur. And agglutination can actually rip holes in your blood vessels, kind of like what you see here. And let me show you also what happens. In certain cases, those red blood cells can actually rupture, and now their hemoglobin can escape. So this can be a really serious transfusion reaction. And in worst case scenario, that clumped up group of red blood cells now heads to your kidneys, and it rips holes in your capillaries. So that can cause kidney damage, bleeding in your kidneys, and loss of whole hemoglobin into the urine. So we're going to learn later on that having whole hemoglobin in the urine is not a good thing. It's an indicator of a transfusion reaction gone wrong. Okay, you with me so far? Haven't lost you anywhere? Don't need to clarify anything so far. Okay. So let's talk about transfusions. So in terms of transfusions, we want to make sure that we have not introduced something foreign to somebody else, because that's going to induce these antibodies to be formed. So these antibodies, if you're talking the ABO blood group, are formed in your body by the time you're 5 years old, just simply through exposure to life, to blood and meats that you may eat, to bacteria that you may be exposed to. So you're going to be exposed to enough foreign antigens by age of 5 that you will have formed antibodies against foreign ABO blood types. So that's the bad news, because now you have a circulating population of antibodies against foreign ABO blood groups. So the first transfusion that you get may not be terribly strong. Why not? You don't have enough antibodies, yet you're trying to fight it off, and it takes time for you to build more antibodies. But the second time you get an incompatible transfusion, how bad is that reaction? That's really bad. So the second time around, you've got these antibodies already formed, they circulate in your blood plasma, and upon exposure to the foreign antigen, they've got that little receptor on each Y arm, and they clump. And so that's a really quick transfusion reaction that can cause really devastating effects, like ripping holes in your capillaries and agglutination. So now that we've kind of got the background laid, let's head to your worksheet, about middle of page 29. And we're going to talk, first of all, specifically about the ABO blood group. Okay, let's see. Let's get you a good picture to look at. So the ABO blood group is probably the most well understood of our blood groups. We do use it most commonly when we talk about blood typing in conversation. And the ABO blood group is based on two antigens, antigen A and antigen B. All right, the second question there says, if you have no antigens, you're considered type O. I want to make a point here about type A, B, and O. There are two antigens that may be present on blood cells, type A or type B. If you've got type A, you've got the A antigen on your blood cell surface. If you're type B, you've got the B antigen on your blood cell surface. If you have neither antigens A or B, then of course you've got what's called type O. That means you have no surface features at all. And basically for that ABO blood group, you have nothing to identify you on the surface of that red blood cell. So type O is like having a naked, uncovered red blood cell surface. What if you have both antigens, A and B? Blood type A, B, good. So if we were to look at the surface of your blood cell, we should in fact see both of those antigens. So the easy thing to remember is, if you have the antigen, that is your blood type. If I have antigen A, my blood type is A. If I'm identified as having antigen B, my blood type is B. The catch to remember is, if I have no antigens, my blood type is O. Okay? And if I've got both A and B antigens, my blood type is AB. It is face value. It is what it is. If you've got the antigen, that's your blood type.
So for type O, when you were saying like you can fight yourself or whatever, does that like cancel any possibility of that?
Yeah, because there's nothing to fight. Yeah, exactly. So you'd probably be less likely to fight yourself if you're O. Yeah. I want to talk to you for a moment about the universal donor and universal recipient. So we know that type O is universal donor, which means it can universally donate to any ABO blood type. And if you think about that, there are no surface antigens here. So if I give this O to A, to B, or to AB, are they going to recognize anything about this cell? It comes in stealth mode, doesn't it? It comes in incognito, like it's not even there. The body is not even going to recognize it because there are no surface antigens by which to identify it. So that is great news for type O. There is a caveat, though, with being the universal donor. In the blood plasma of the O person, The O type carries antibodies against type A and type B. Okay, remember the story? By age 5, you've built your antibodies against any foreign ABO blood types. So by age 5, type O already built anti-A and anti-B antibodies. So if we give a whole blood donation, plasma, red blood cells, white blood cells, everything in there, if we give a whole blood donation, we're not only giving the O blood type, but we're also giving anti-A and anti-B antibodies. Do you see any problem giving this blood to type A person? What's going to happen to type A person's blood? Yeah, anti-A antibodies are going to fight those A antigens. So it's not a big deal. It's usually not enough to cause any problems, but nonetheless, we can't say it's 100% risk-free. There's actually a tiny bit of risk here with giving that blood to a person with another blood type because of those anti-A and anti-B antibodies. Let's talk about it this way. If I give type O blood to type AB blood, in terms of red blood cells, we're good, we're compatible. But if I do a whole blood donation, I'm also giving anti-A and anti-B antibodies. What's going to happen to type AB's blood? It's going to fight it, right? And what's it called when the Y-shaped antibody grabs on?
Agglutination,
yeah. Is the first transfusion or the second transfusion the mildest? The first. Why? Right, there's not a lot of antibodies that are coming, but of course the second one would be a more severe reaction. Not such a big issue if we're doing a transfusion into someone's body. So, you know, we're limited by how many times we transfuse into that body. So this person is only going to have a limited supply of antibodies for us to give away. So coming into that person's body is not necessarily such a big issue. Okay. The universal recipient, though, is AB. So that, of course, is the type over here on the right-hand side. Does that person carry any anti-A or anti-B antibodies? They're not going to fight themselves, right? Okay, so they have actually no antibodies to fight. But here's the catch. If we give them type B blood, does that person carry any antibodies? Anti-A. Type A blood carries anti-B, right? Okay, so either of those, blood cell-wise, are perfectly compatible with your AB blood. Okay, the antigens are certainly not foreign. The only small risk we run with this universal recipient thing is the fact that the person giving the blood to the AB blood type may carry antibodies against those antigens. So there may be a small risk for agglutination if we give a transfusion. The liver and the spleen get rid of these antibodies. They're processed out of your body. And so there's probably little problem, but nonetheless, there is still not, you can't say it's 100% risk-free. Okay. So let's talk about the rules for blood typing near the bottom of your page. Okay, so that's mostly about the ABO blood types. I do want to mention in terms of the Rh factor, you don't actually form antibodies during the first 5 years of life like you do for the ABO group. You only form antibodies against the Rh factor after you're exposed through a transfusion or through pregnancy. So kind of an odd case there. It doesn't seem to be sensitized the same way as ABO is sensitized. Last thing on the bottom of page 29, I'll draw your attention down there. It says in an emergency, any blood type may be given in a transfusion because it takes time for antibodies to be built and the life-saving process can go ahead and begin. And then we can worry about the transfusion reaction later on. So in an emergency, they will grab any blood type and give it to you, even if it's completely incompatible, and then worry about that transfusion issue later on. So they can give immunosuppressant drugs called corticosteroids. You've talked about those, right? Those corticosteroids can suppress the immune system. Now, was that aldosterone, cortisol, or sex hormones that suppressed the immune response? Cortisol, yeah. So cortisol could be given, or a derivative of those glucocorticoids, to stop your immune response there. All right, so let's turn on over and talk about the Rh factor for just a moment. Rh factor is totally different from the ABO blood groups. It's just one of another set of identifiable blood antigens found on red blood cell surfaces. If you have the Rh factor, you have an antigen, and this particular antigen is actually present in 85% of the population. So most of us are walking around with an Rh factor or an Rh antigen. Those who don't have it are considered to be Rh negative. What does that mean? Do you have the antigen if you're negative? No. Let me put it to you this way. If you go for a flu test, they swab you and they say, let's see if you've got the flu. If it comes back that you are positive, you've got the flu, right? If you're Rh positive, you've got the antigen. What if it comes back and says that you're negative? You don't have the flu. So Rh negative means you don't carry the antigen. So Rh factor or antigen is found in most of us, meaning that we're Rh positive, meaning we're positive for that particular antigen. I did want you to know, you may hear this alternate name, Rh is sometimes called the D antigen. Okay, so just in case you run into that, Rh is also known as the D antigen. So you are not sensitized against the Rh factor if you are in fact negative during your childhood years. You actually have to be exposed to it if you're Rh negative, either through pregnancy or through a transfusion. So right now, I'm talking to those who are Rh negative. If you are Rh negative and you get a transfusion, the first transfusion is likely a very mild transfusion. What we mean is, if I am Rh negative and you give me any form of Rh positive blood, that Rh antigen now stimulates my immune system to produce those Y-shaped antibodies. So it's going to take some time for those antibodies to be formed, and so we do tend to see a rather slow, mild reaction the first time we have a foreign exposure. But behold, the immune system. The immune system will continue to stock these antibodies, and the second time you're exposed to that foreign Rh antigen, your body says, I've seen you before, I've got these antibodies ready to attack, and so along comes another foreign Rh antigen, and the attraction this time is more severe. So the second go around for an Rh transfusion reaction is a more severe transfusion reaction. Agglutination occurs, kidney damage can occur. So is there anything you can do to prevent the second more severe transfusion reaction? There's a shot you can give. Yeah, it's a corticosteroid type shot. It shuts down that formation of antibodies. So, you know, if it's an emergency, they're going into life-saving mode. They grab any bag of blood to give you for that first transfusion. They can give you a shot that stops the formation of those antibodies for the second go-around. So if you ever have to have another second transfusion of Rh-positive blood, they can actually stop the reaction from occurring from being more severe. Now, where this really comes into play is pregnancy. 85% of the population is Rh positive, only 15% is Rh negative. Right now, I'm focused on moms-to-be who are Rh negative. So what does that mean about their blood type? They don't have the Rh antigen, right. Now, they could be AB, or O. That's not the issue right now. The issue is they don't have an Rh antigen. So the assumption is for a mom who is Rh negative is that she's probably carrying a baby who's positive. 85% of the population is positive, so most likely the dad is probably a positive Rh factor person. You'll notice here that during the first pregnancy, the exposure to those Rh antigens is going to produce antibodies in mom. Those antibodies cross the placenta and begin to attack the baby's red blood cells. Why the red blood cells? They carry the antigen, right? They're on the surface of that red blood cell. And so, you know, babies start out really tiny. and then they grow to be about 20 inches long. And over the course of 40 weeks of pregnancy, it takes time for mom to build antibodies. So this first baby may be born okay, damage may be mild. It may be anything from brain damage to anemia to hypoxia, but this baby may be born with relatively mild issues. Let's say that the baby is, or the, let's say that this is 200 years ago and we have no way to suppress antibodies. Mom gets pregnant a second time with another positive baby. What's waiting for that baby?
Antibodies.
What happens this time?
Bad reaction.
Bad reaction, right. So what kinds of problems occur in that baby's body?
Can't transport oxygen.
Can't transport oxygen. What else? Transfusion reaction. Big time damage, right? These big clumps of cells that have been attacked by antibodies are now going to travel through kidneys and capillaries. So the baby could be born, if it's born, with kidney damage. But it's also very possible the baby's born stillborn. So this could happen where you have one healthy or somewhat healthy baby, and then stillborn, miscarriage, stillborn. And then you maybe hit another baby where it could be born with relatively minor problems. But most likely what we see is once those antibodies are in circulation, then we have problem after problem if that baby happens to be a positive baby. Just a thought here, is there really any issue if mom is positive and baby is negative? So who's forming the antibodies in that setup? Mom or baby? The baby. And if the baby forms antibodies, and it will, is there a really big chance that the baby's gonna harm mom? Why not? Who's bigger? Mom. So mom being a bigger body is gonna take a lot more antibodies to harm her, so it's highly unlikely there's gonna be any issue going in that direction. So I wanna make a point here. The issue is for negative moms and positive babies. And so nowadays, they give a Rogam shot. That Rogam shot should be given twice, once during pregnancy and again at birth, and that prevents the formation of those antibodies against the Rh factor. So the complicated and really fancy name for this in pregnant moms is called hemolytic disease of the newborn. What is hemolysis? Ruptured air blood cells, and an alternate name for it is erythroblastosis fetalis. Once again, erythro sounds like erythrocyte or red blood cell, and fetalis, of course, meaning fetus. So in any case, whichever term you use to describe this issue, the issue is for negative moms when they carry a positive baby. Right, sometimes the baby's not positive, sometimes the baby's negative, but they do the same treatment with the Rogam shot.
They don't have a way of knowing.
They don't have a way of knowing, yeah.
Because that's like the standard thing.
Right, if mom comes in and tests negative, they treat her as if she's carrying a positive baby no matter what. Yep. Any of you been in the situation of having a negative blood type carrying a positive baby?
Wow.
And actually, my mom's orange negative. But I guess they treated her
anyway. My son is positive. Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
And my son is positive. So.
Any complications or? That's good. So you're negative and he's negative. That's good. That makes everything a lot easier when it works that way. Okay. So what I would like to do with you now is take you over to page 31. Make sure you feel comfortable completing most of this chart. You've done this in lab, right? Is this something you need help and guidance with, or is it something you feel like you could do on your own? I don't mind walking you through it. Good. Okay, that's all I need to hear. All right, so let's start off with blood type A positive. I do want to clarify here that I'm actually combining the ABO group with the Rh group, and so we're saying that if you have antigen A, and the Rh factor, you're considered to be Rh positive. So we're looking at two different blood types kind of combined together. So let's do type A positive first. And I just drew an antigen A all over the surface. I'm going to go ahead and put some positives on there. And this particular blood type has two antigens, antigen A and what else?
Rh.
Rh, good. Okay, I've got a rule list in the back of my head. There are only three antigens we've dealt with so far today. Antigen A, antigen B, and the Rh factor. I can only build antibodies against antigens. I cannot build antibodies against what's not there to fight. You can't fight an invisible enemy, right? So I've already got antigen A and the Rh factor. That means the only one I haven't been exposed to or don't have is B. So the antibody that I would build is anti-B antibodies. All right, so far so good. Now, when we're looking at who we can receive blood from, we have to make sure we're compatible in terms of antigens and that our antibodies won't fight that foreign blood type. It is safe to say we can receive our own blood type, which is A positive. What else can we receive? O positive.
O negative.
O negative. You got it. Good. Can I get anything with B?
Mm-hmm.
Why not?
It's an A.
We've got an anti-B antibody. We would fight and clump anything with B. So I can't get B, I can't get AB because of that B antigen. So that's who I can receive from if I need the transfusion. If I'm going into the Red Cross and I want to donate blood, I might say, hey, I'm A positive. Who can I give my blood away to? Obviously yourself, and who else? A positive and AB positive, good. If I'm A positive, can I give my blood to A negative? I cannot because I am introducing
Rh
factor. Yes, so not a good match there. Hey, in an emergency, we'd do it anyway. We would do something about it later on, but ideally, you wouldn't want to do that particular combination. Could I give my blood to, say, O positive? I could not because I've got an A antigen. Yeah, I would introduce into them a foreign antigen that they would then, in turn, have to fight. Okay. Let's do A negative. This time, we only carry one antigen. Which one? Just A. All right, what kinds of antibodies do we carry? So I would already have the anti-B antibodies, but I would build the anti-Rh upon exposure, either through pregnancy or through exposure during a transfusion. Otherwise, you can be 80 years old, never having received a transfusion, never having formed anti-Rh antibodies. So it just takes that exposure through a transfusion or pregnancy to build those. If we're A negative, we can only receive two blood types. What are they? Good. A negative and O negative. A negative walks into the Red Cross and says, I'm here to donate blood. Who can I give my blood away to?
A negative.
A negative.
A positive.
A positive. I heard one of you say it.
A B.
A B. Good. Mess with your brain a little bit. Please don't, right? why is it okay to give A negative or A positive to A, B blood types?
They don't have any antibodies.
They don't have any antibodies? And are you giving them an antigen they haven't seen before? Antigen-wise, it's okay. What, though, do you carry in your blood plasma? And anti-B antibodies. So is it 100% risk-free to give our blood to the AB person? Not really yet. So there's a small risk there. Better to do the transfusion than to have the person risk dying. But nonetheless, there's a small risk of a transfusion reaction. It's going to be mild, if anything. That recipient's body is going to destroy those anti-B antibodies and get rid of them. So any reaction that occurs there would be mild. Are you so far so good? Okay. How about questions so far? All right, let's do the Bs. Let's start off with B positive. So B positive carries what antigens?
B and Rh.
B and Rh, good. Well, we've got two of the three antigens, so we would build antibodies against anti-A. Now, this person would receive four blood types, possibly in a transfusion. They are?
B positive, B negative, O positive, O negative.
You got it. Good. B positive, B negative. O positive and O negative. And we can only give this blood to?
B positive and AB positive.
B positive and AB positive. Good. I know it's a pain in the butt to every time you want to talk about antibodies to say this mouthful of anti-B antibodies, but I promise you it will keep you straight come test time, because there is an essay question on the test, guaranteed, that's going to say, we've got so-and-so with this blood type, and they've been given this blood type in a blood transfusion. Discuss if it's a good compatibility. And sometimes people get lost in their language, and if you are routine and you're consistent, always using this terminology here, anti-A antibodies or anti-B or whatever, then you're less likely to get that confused on the multiple choice and on the essays for the test. So I know it's a mouthful to keep straight, but I encourage you to constantly and consistently say anti-so-and-so antibodies. I think it will pay off for you come, you know, long run. Let's do B negative. This one only has one antigen. That one is
B.
B, good. Any antibodies here?
Anti-A, Rh.
Good, okay. Transfusion, this B negative person can receive blood from?
B negative.
Good. Let me pause you here and talk about something. Obviously, getting B negative, if you yourself are B negative, is great, right? Everything's good to go. In terms of antigens, do you see any issue of getting O negative? Antigen-wise, you're great, right? What antibodies does O negative carry? Anti-A, anti-B. Do you see any concern for this person to get that O blood? Small problem, right? So small risk of transfusion reaction occurs if you get that O negative blood, which carries anti-B and anti-A and anti-B and anti-Rh antibodies. Boy, that's a mouthful to keep straight. Okay, B negative walks in the blood bank, going to give this blood away to four types. What are they?
A
You got it. Can we give this B blood to anyone who is O? Because you give them B antigens, right? And their blood would, of course, clump or agglutinate. All right, let's see. AB positive is next. What antigens does this one carry?
AB and RH.
AB and RH, good. Any antibodies?
No.
No antibodies. This one is sometimes called the universal
recipient.
Good. Okay, in a transfusion, this person can receive what?
Everything.
Good. So that makes it easy. And this person can only give away to AB positive. Yeah, themselves. Right. You guys complete AB negative on your own. You can check yourself up here when you're ready. You're working. I'm going to let you finish O positive and O negative, and you can check yourself. Okay, so for the ones that are left, which one's a universal donor?
O negative.
O negative. Okay, why O negative?
Doesn't have the Rh factor.
Right. Doesn't have the Rh factor, goes to anybody. Now, we're talking in terms of antigen compatibility, right? Because the little dirty secret in the background is they carry anti-A, anti-B, and anti-RH antibodies. So the dirty little secret is, antigen-wise, it's compatible, but these antibodies can cause small issues, small risk of agglutination. So how about questions so far? Let's see, on the next page, on 32, you've got a whole set of practice problems. You can go nuts with those 50 if you like. I would only encourage you to do as many as it takes to get yourself comfortable. It may take 10 or 20, but hey, if you need all 50, they are there for you. The answers are on D2L in the announcement. Scroll all the way to the bottom of the current announcement, and it should say answers to the blood typing exercises, and those 50 should be listed. If you get stuck or if you're not quite sure you're doing it right and you want to talk through, feel free to come see me. This is something that's really important to get straight. It's like riding a bike. Once you got it, you're good. It's just getting you to that comfort level to take the training wheels off, all right? Okay. Do you have any questions I can clarify for you today? All right, come Wednesday, we're going to go back to the beginning of this chapter, and we're going to work on just basic blood info, okay?